Danny Cohen, nephew, and things aging well or badly. I was going to suggest lookalikes, but that's just trivial in comparison.
Compared to the other very important topics that we talk about.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Christian Corley. I'm the editor of Casterbras.com. You're listening to the podcast with a K. With me is James McLean and Brian Terranova. How are you doing, guys?
Very good.
Pucker, thank you.
Pardon?
Pucker.
Oh, beg your pardon. Sorry, I thought you said something else.
Yeah. Olivonian, isn't it?
Olivonian, is that what we're calling it?
I think so.
Jamie Oliver, what a legend. So, have you had a good week, guys, of Doctor Who free TV?
Yeah, I can't complain, really.
Yeah?
Yeah, I say, as I said to you just before the podcast, I've been substituting it with Quantum Leap and an extremely odd passion that I've developed for My Name is Earl. Yes, it's becoming...
That is an odd passion.
It's becoming like a love affair, because I know it's over. It's been over for about 2 years now.
Yeah.
And it's hurting me. Do you get that hurt? I mean, you might have had it when Doctor Who finished, or when you used to watch The End of Survival, and you'd feel that sort of pain knowing that you'd lost it, it was gone.
No, I think I got it when Ashes to Ashes ended.
Yeah, you know what I mean then.
Yeah.
It's a sort of a sorrow, a sort of bitter sorrow, like a relationship's parted.
Quantum Leap, though. I mean, that hasn't aged very well, has it?
No, Christian, that's a very interesting point. Sorry. Christian made this point earlier before the podcast, and I just love the way he's phrasing it, as if it's a brand new one. Yes, I don't know. I still find it slightly timeless, because at the same time, it does feel very rooted in its time.
Yeah.
It feels like a quality version of what they were always trying to do during the 80s. And yet somehow Quantum Leap would just keep you there, which other 80s shows never managed to do. It was really weird.
So when did it air? Was it sort of late 80s to early 90s?
That's correct. I believe so.
Right. So there's a lot of shows from that era that don't seem to have aged that well. I mean, that's certainly not the only one. There's British shows and American shows that don't seem to have aged particularly well. But do you think it's a kind of a circular thing? I mean, say 5 or 10 years ago, if we were watching, I don't know, I won't use Time Rush as an example, Earthshock, perhaps, or The Visitation, would we have felt that that was perhaps hadn't aged too well, whereas now we can look at it and they're both kind of classic epics?
That's a hard one for me to say, really, because when I look at those shows, it's definitely a different film technique.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Filming Doctor Who, and I mean, if you're talking about like American 80s shows, certainly I can obviously relate to those. And the one thing I've noticed is with 80s shows, there was a definite shift in how TV was filmed from the 80s to about the mid 90s, where it's actually commonly held in the film world that the X-Files actually made a shift in TV drama. They started telling movies each week. They started filming movies each week. But even if you look at their first two seasons, you can tell that they still kind of have that 80s kind of, you know, filmic style a little bit while they're trying to cross over in the movie genre. And then all of a sudden they made this explosion into the movie world. And then, of course, American TV just, for the most part, most TV shows do that. And they have this now, this theater quality to them. Whereas shows like Quantum Leap, you would think would have aged well, because each week they're going to a different period, you know, doing a different period piece, you know, the 60s, the 40s, the 50s, whatever. So you would think they would be able to do them in a nice timeless fashion. But it's that more so the film technique that they use. They filmed like a TV show. And well, I think that's what aged it.
What I was going to also go on to was the fact that a few days ago I caught a bit of the TV movie.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, James, but me and Brian love the TV movie. It isn't perfect by any means, but there's loads of great stuff in there, and there's obviously Paul McGann. And
that could be taken either way. There's lots of great stuff in there, and there's Paul McGann.
No, there is Paul McGann, and Paul McGann's fantastic as the Eighth Doctor.
Absolutely,
he's absolutely marvellous. He's unrivaled, he's unparalleled in his doctorness in the space of, what, he's only in it for half an hour, isn't he, or something like that?
Half an hour. One go as a doctor, and he totally sold me. He would have made a fantastic... doctor in the long run, certainly.
I don't know.
Anyway, we'll come to that another day, okay? My point was, the bit that I saw, I was watching this, blimey, this looks dated. And I don't know whether I'm in just that general mood at the moment, where everything I look at that's older than, you know, 2 years off, think, blimey, that looks dated.
Well, okay, let's pin you down. What made you think it looked dated?
I think it may, well, I mean, one of them's an element of the film that's always been there, which is the script isn't great. And neither's that twin guy who plays Chang Li.
Yeah.
He's not great either. But there was just felt somewhat insincere and not quite meaningful to anything, really. And I suppose those are things that have been there all the time. But we're now in an age where Doctor Who has started playing around with, you know, satire and bringing in real, you know, problems in from real life, sort of like the issue of cloning and things in Gangers, or, you know, the weapons of mass destruction in Aliens of London, that kind of thing. Whereas back then, it was a one-off return, and it was all quite frivolous in many ways. And I think that's true of many shows from that time. They weren't particularly relevant.
I was just going to say that you were talking earlier about The X-Files, and I always felt when I first saw the TV movie, that I did feel that it was an uncomfortable mix of trying to emulate some of the feels of The X-Files. There's a lot of cold colours in there.
There's lots of blues.
Exactly. There's a lot of orchestra in there. They got a female lead, which had a slight Scullyism feel to her, sort of a doctor, red hair. It did feel a bit as if there was bits of The X-Files in there, but as if the script and the tone of the film hadn't actually caught up with where The X-Files was going, and still felt like it was sort of about 1991. And playing with sort of sliders, like drama on time travel, the sort of time travel that had been considered in TV for the last 20 years and wasn't actually very serious, hadn't really been thought through. And yeah, and you had to have the car chase as well.
What do you think,
Brian? Oh, come on, don't go there with the car chase. Watch the John Pertwee era and then tell me it's an American thing to have a car chase.
Yeah, I've got to agree with Brian.
We're not. But as far as the film quality, or rather the dating of the show, I agree. It was 96, so they made it in 94, 95, which means it was right in that shift when TV started making that shift to, hey, you know what? We don't need to make TV shows like TV shows anymore. We can make TV shows like movies. And so they were trying their best to give it that filmic quality. They're still filming in the old format, the old TV format, rather than switching to widescreen, which probably would have helped loads as well. But script-wise, they never nailed it. I mean, like Christian said, we love it, but we know that it has its faults. But they never nailed it in the fact that they never let it evolve. They just kind of wanted to throw in as much history as they could at the audience to get them caught up, rather than allowing the story to unfold naturally or do character developments as they naturally and probably should have. Because, I mean, Chang Li was so underdeveloped as a character. He was just kind of like almost a pointless waste to have there. But looking at the show, one thing that's interesting is if you look at his character outfit-wise, like costume-wise, you could probably see somebody like him in a TV show today. It's not actually that bad, but somebody like Grace, she's got the big shoulder pads in her jacket and everything. I mean, it was mid-90s. Those should not have been there. That was late 80s stuff. You know, like, that totally dated your show even before you started filming it. So there's a bit of a visual aging to it as well, and it was all poor stylistic choices.
Well, you see, I don't think it was. I mean, a lot of people have said it's because it was too desperate to try and throw in as many fan things in there as possible. And I've always disagreed with that. I mean, they're obviously there, and I think it's kind of sweet that they were put there. But the issues with the story, it is simply the fact, is that it's a very bland, pastiche TV movie. The structure is, I hope I didn't make you feel too defensive on the point of the car chase, but there is a very true point that there is that car chases have always been a far more staple part of American action dramas, and they have been TV, maybe just simply because you've got a better budget, you've got bigger roads, whatever. But as a British person watching it, it started to feel like it was just throwing in all the sort of very standard points that make an American TV movie.
I'm sorry, go on.
I agree that we used car chases as well. It was less to be a derogatory point, more of a satirical point British people always define American shows by the fact there's got to be a car chase in there.
Yeah, no, and it's, I'm not arguing that. I mean, I get that. We do have car chases. We have tons of explosions. It is something that we do. But watching Doctor Who and all these years and hearing people say that that was such an American thing to do, But I'm telling you, like, you watch just the John Pertwee era alone, and certainly Planet of Spiders, as I said, with all those things, I mean, they're all there. But the other thing is that I find interesting about it is the script was written by a British writer.
Yeah.
Sure, he was writing for the American market, but it was a British writer, you know?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to say, I think using the term written is really too precise for it, because what it is really is cobbled together. It's absolutely horrific.
Well, okay, say, I mean...
And what I'm just going to say as well, one of the things... I mean, one of the complaints about it is that a lot of it doesn't make sense. But if you, and I know Brian and I have had this conversation before, there's a key element of the script that was removed for apparently no reason, which would have made the whole thing make sense.
What was that?
This is the, because when it's taking place, 1999, there's some celestial body coming past the Earth. And in possibly the draft before the final one, or before it, before they turned into a camera script, this body was still there. And this affects the whole turning the planet inside out and enables the TARDIS to go back in time and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
You see, so there's all these things that are surrounding this, and they just took this element out and left all the things that depend on it in. And all of a sudden it doesn't make sense.
And that's the thing with scripts anytime. I mean, like, you even see it in new Doctor Who sometimes, or any TV show under the sun. Scripts that go through any sort of revision, there's always some elements that get dropped, but you drop the main element and traces of those things you forgot to remove. So there's always some traces or hints, not always, but usually you'll find these, that just don't make sense any longer because that main bit that made them work or made them, you know... make sense in your mind, that they were removed and those trace elements are left behind to do nothing but sit there and make fans go, what the heck was that? So certainly in the writer's choice here, and I forget the writer's name all of a sudden, but
Matthew Jacobs,
yes, thank you, he must have been told rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, yeah, a million times, because you had so many hands in the pot. You had the BBC, you had Universal Studios, you had Fox, yeah, Studios. I think there was even one more and I don't remember who that was, but you know, that can't be a good situation. My thing with the history, and I'll be honest, as a fan, certainly at the period that I found the show, all that history being thrown at you, I did love it because I was a fan and I loved all that stuff then. I see why it's maybe wrong now. Yeah. But my issue wasn't the fact that it was there. It was how it was brought up being there.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it was kind of like they were just throwing it at you rather than having it have any kind of relevance at the moment. And that was kind of part of it as well. It seemed like Philip Seagal had a checklist of, I want these things in here. You know what? Why don't you just throw it in that scene, and rather than actually have it make sense? And that's how it felt. But
it didn't
I do love the thing.
It didn't even need to have the whole thing about the Doctor having many lives in it.
Well, I
not
think
at all. Not in the first,
you know,
story.
the thing with the Master nicking the Doctor's life, he could have just needed to nick the Doctor's Rassilon imprimatur, not call it that, but his ability to fly the TARDIS, therefore having him done up in the Clockwork Orange stuff. It didn't need to go into the whole regeneration thing.
I think you're right. I think I perhaps had to concede a little when I said that the fan stuff was fine in there. I think you're right to a certain degree. Yes, from talking about this, there was a lot of deployment that didn't need to be there. I remember Sylvester McCoy saying a little later that he would have actually, retrospectively, rather he had not been in it, and they'd just let it start with McGann, and then in a few episodes later, if it got a series, go back with McCoy and show how that happened once everything had been established and allowed that first pilot to breathe. But saying that, for me, and not as a fan, just as a watcher, and interestingly, if you broke it up into four parts, like the old Doctor Who episodes, the first part, the first 23 minutes or so, ends pretty much with McGann in his Jesus-like cloth, sort of going, who am I? That, to me, is the most interesting part, that first 23 minutes, I think.
Yeah.
It's very fanny, but it just kept my interest. But after that, it did just sort of hit the formula. And I think you're probably right. I think it's unfair to Seagal, probably unfair to Matthew Jacobs, but it does feel like there was a lot of imposing of standard Hollywood, I don't know, tropes, whatever you want to call it, possibly network decisions, just to make sure that it was consumable rather than interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's where
Absolutely.
It fell apart. And
I think it would have been good to completely eschew a lot of the previous stuff and have Grace come across the Doctor in some other means, find that this mysterious bloke, possibly following back, echoing an unearthly child, find that he's got a knackered TARDIS and he's kind of limited to Los Angeles or San Francisco, wherever it was set. I think it was San Francisco, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And as the series goes on, he investigates stuff, as the Doctor tends to do, maybe alien invasions, mad scientists, that kind of thing. And as the weeks go on, the TARDIS develops more of its function so it can go backwards and forwards in time but can't leave Earth. And then the end of the first series, get the chance to leave Earth.
Which is a better plot than, if I remember rightly, what their original plans were for it, with the Master being the Doctor's brother and the father
and Egyptology and
some terrible stuff.
Hammer of the Gods and all that sort of thing.
Going quickly back...
Not Hammer of the Gods, Led Zeppelin again. Then.
Going back to your original point, just to dovetail this, does it feel dated? Mm. Yeah, it does for me, because it feels as if it doesn't push itself in the way that I tend to feel that TV these days tries to. Yeah. But saying that, there has been a lot of TV this last few years that's come back, which has started to feel very 80s, very Quantum Leap, very McGann movie. Things like Monk, Numbers. There's a lot of shows which...
Well, Numbers has been running a while, hasn't it? It must be getting on for 10 years nearly, surely.
Well,
no, that's true, though. But James brings up a good point, though, because I have watched shows like Monk, and I watch Numbers like once or twice. You're right. They have that diagnosis murder feel to them.
Yes.
Kind of like they have it's kind of like you either make quality TV or you make afternoon TV. And while they may be primetime Numbers, they look like they're afternoon TV. They look like they're almost soap opera quality. Like they're not trying to make a film; they're just trying to do the paint-by-numbers TV of the old times. I had thought of that before, so I'm glad you brought that up. They do have a very different stylistic feel.
Yeah,
so,
I've never seen Monk, but I've seen Numbers a few times. That's quite good. But don't diss the Diagnosis Murder.
But that's
me.
It.
I'm not putting it down. I'm saying it definitely has an era feel to it, certainly, and a very stylistic film quality that screams, you know, 80s.
And that's exactly what I find with Quantum Leap. I find it has that afternoon feel, but it's at the top of its league at doing afternoon feel drama, because it pulls you in. Mm. And so, yes, it does feel dated in a way. But as you say, I think there is a cycle going on. And I think in the midst of all the arcs and all the 24s and the Galacticas and everything else, that there has been this call for this more simple consumable TV, which perhaps... then they're just not Quantum Leap enough.
Right. And the thing is that you have to remember, some people just like that hour worth of television and they enjoy it and they do want to come back next week and they just want to see that hour worth of television. They don't archive it the way that we do. They don't have every aspect stuck in their head. So trying to follow a plot point that carries over for an entire season, you have to remember something that happened in episode 1 all the way down in episode 13 and all these other plot points. And some people just don't have that kind of catalog running in their head.
There's been plenty of other shows here. I know I'm being quite defensive about it, but I mean, if we're following on from the age of Lost or Battlestar Galactica or Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes, these things have been popping up all along, and you know, there's websites out there that help people out with these things. So I don't think really anything that Doctor Who's doing now is particularly new. Although, I mean, it's good for Doctor Who. They're doing stuff that Doctor Who's never done before.
Yeah.
No, I agree with you there. But the point is does Doctor Who and does Lost get 100% of the viewing ratings?
And
exactly, that's the thing. You know how many people I know that actually started to watch Lost and literally said, "I'm lost," and stopped watching it? It's because that type of storytelling isn't for everyone. I never really got into Lost myself for different reasons, not because of all the time travel aspects. I'm told I would really love that kind of thing, but I got very bored by people being trapped on an island. That bored the pants off me. And I understand they shifted that a little bit in later seasons, but just watching people sitting on an island every day, That did nothing for me. But if I were to watch the show, I'm sure I'd be able to catalog it just as I do Doctor Who, everything that's going on. Mm. Some people just aren't into it. They don't want to give that kind of dedication to a show.
But again, I've still got to put the same point forward. Is it's not so much about whether the show should be complicated or not. It's about the mandate the show is there to fulfill. And the Lost's mandate, I would argue, has a different mandate to Doctor Who, which has got a very wider audience to cater for. So that's the issue, is trying to find that balance between making it more complex, interesting, and pushing the boundaries, and at the same time making sure that you're not losing elements of that audience that you're meant to be supplying, and including the young and the old, because families, it's a family show. So that would be my concern. I don't think it's a big concern. I think it's all in hand, but that would be my differential between Lost and Doctor Who.
I think this might be something we'll come back to during the off-season. As we will now call it, until season 6 resumes. Before we get on to our next main subject, which is something that is, we're all aware of, did you guys see the original design or an original design for the nephew character from the Doctor's wife?
Well, I read this really great website called Casterbris.com. I don't know
if you've heard of it.
And on there, they have this picture that you're talking about.
Wow.
I thought that was pretty fantastic looking design, really. If you haven't seen it, both of you should probably check out that website, I would say.
Okay, I will do, yeah. Have you seen it, James?
Well, the joke is I haven't. So I'm going to Casterbris just now and having a quick look. Yes, the original, it's on Casterbris.com, would you know?
Is it?
It is at the moment. You might have to look back. Oh, crikey, yes, that is interesting. Yes, go to Casterbris.com and have a look at this picture. It's quite a good site, you know. I hear the people who work on the podcast sometimes go and look at it.
I'll go check that out right now, actually. Good. Thank you for the recommendation.
I think we'll put a link in the podcast page for this particular news item. Basically, the guy who designed, done a lot of designs for Doctor Who, including The Silence for Doctor Who Series 6 and Series 5. I believe he did stuff in Cold Blood. He did an original design for the nephew character, which was eventually taken by a nude for cost reasons. And the nephew design's pretty stunning. If you're on the train or the sub or whatever at the moment listening to this, basically the creature has a kind of segmented face down most three quarters of it, and then on the left hand side of its head, his own left hand side, a kind of brain turning into spikes pouring out of the side of the head. So is that a fair description, do you think, guys?
It looks to me as if the Ood had a film or play called The Elephant Man or The Elephant Ood. That would be The Elephant Ood.
Yeah, I think they're both fair assessments there.
Yeah.
I think the main thing that I liked about the design was that they also, it had the Frankenstein element to it. It looked like that he was like patchwork, like aunt and uncle were, which was the point. They were having their life augmented by the travelers that came there. You know, the house got the TARDIS to feed off of while aunt and uncle got to survive by being, you know, patched up with all the other dead bodies. And I know Idris didn't have that. So it's understandable that the Ood might not have that. They may have both been fairly new, but they made it seem like, you know, nephew was there for quite a while. I think this design would have much more suited the story.
Yeah, but obviously it's something that we lost through to budgetary reasons.
Right.
Now, this all dovetails into nicely, I think, the recent news of Doctor Who Series 7 potentially, because we still haven't had a straightforward this is what's happening answer. So if I'm phrasing any of this in any way that offends you, first of all, get lost.
And what else is new?
Yeah. No, but seriously, though, if there's anything that's factually incorrect, by all means, feel free to drop us a polite email. The emphasis is on polite, particularly Twitter users.
And email, rather than a brick through the window.
Yeah, and email, yeah. Yeah. So, Doctor Who Series 7 is apparently not taking place when we might expect it to take place, that being probably March, April 2012. As we've seen over the last couple of weeks with the news in Private Eye, things that have happened since then, Stephen Moffat on Twitter, and BBC One controller Danny Cohen at the recent Church and Media event, it possibly won't air at all in 2012, or if it does, it'll just be certain a few episodes of Doctor Who Series 13. Now, Series 7, and then the rest of it will occur in 2013 for Doctor Who's 50th anniversary. Now, as we say at the moment, we don't really know what's going on in terms of what we get in 2012, what we don't get in 2012. The smart money is on half of Series 7 in 2012, and the other half in 2013, and then possibly repeating the exercise the following year, thereby moving Doctor Who to a winter schedule. Now, that sounds fair enough, doesn't it, guys?
It does sound, with all the different rumors or all the different comments that are being made, it does sound like that's the shift that's happening, at least that the series is going to be split between 2012 and 2013, which kind of makes it feel a little bit better that there won't be a complete gap year for 2012. But then it goes back to what we were saying, maybe a couple podcasts before, or maybe just even in private, I can't keep this stuff straight anymore. But the whole spin for Series 6, the divide for Series 6 was supposed to be that you were never more than 3 to 4 months away from new Doctor Who. And then now after Series 6 is done, you know, what's that gap going to be like? And but what is the main reason, though? I mean, is it just trying to move it to a winter slot? Because you could tell an entire 13 series run in 2012 in a fall winter slot, and you're just pushing it back slightly.
Yeah,
you know, you're not pushing it back immensely far. There's got to be something more to it, you know, that the BBC is blaming Sherlock and Stephen Moffat saying it has nothing to do with Sherlock. Well, what's going on? Just say. The fans want to know when their show is coming back and why they have to wait so long. Why does it have to be so secretive?
I've got my own limited experience of PR, and from what I can see, and, you know, just watching what the BBC does with various things, such as launches of series, you know, what happened with Christopher Eccleston back in 2005. What's happened over the last few weeks has been a rather embarrassing drip feed of conflicting information. Even if there is a reason that they don't want to let us in on, which seems to be the case, and if the stories or intimation that was printed in Private Eye concerning Piers Wenger and Beth Willis, if those things are true, or not, you know, that's something that they need to get on with and deal with and sort out and overcome on their own. But, and this is the main point, in 2012, there's two big things happening that could affect Doctor Who. Now, the reason I mention this is that none of these things have been used as a reason. And these are very strong reasons. There's two things. First of all, there's the move from Upper Boat to the new custom-built studios in BBC Wales. Second, there's this little thing called the Olympic Games. Mm. And the amount of resources that the BBC would have to divert from other areas, personnel, that kind of thing, in order to focus on the Olympic Games, which is taking place in various cities around the UK, as well as, obviously, London. None of those things have been cited as a reason, which is what you would expect a smart PR person to do. Certainly what I would expect a smart PR person to do if there was something else going on.
That's a very good point, because I don't know how it is in the UK when the football seasons are on and so on with regular TV shows, but when our football or our baseball is on, TV shows often get preempted and held up. And I suspect partly that's why a lot of these TV shows started taking these early mid-season breaks. Mm. Because constantly, I remember, you know, late 90s, mid 90s, whichever, hooked on so many TV shows, and then all of a sudden one week you'd tune in and it just wouldn't be there, and I had no clue why. There was some baseball game on and so on. It's like, yeah. why does this baseball game need to interrupt my TV show, you know? So perhaps it is delayed because the Olympic Games are going to be aired all over the place, and they would have just naturally delayed it anyway. But if that's the case, like you said, why is that not being cited? I mean, that's understandable.
I still wonder whether there is, if there is something to do more with the Moffat camp. And again, this is entire speculation with no real evidence. But I mean, there's been talk from a few people that maybe, when Moffat made this announcement that season 6 was going to be split, there was talk there that this was to do with Sherlock, that he was finding it very hard to focus on Sherlock and Doctor Who, and split within the season would actually help him juggle balls. And then for this to come out through, it was Kern, wasn't it, who sort of suggested slightly jovially that Moffat wanted needed more space to do Sherlock as well. Again, it's speculation. And I wondered, and I said this to Brian, I wondered if that was either a political or a jab. Because, I mean, as Private Eye seemed to point out, there seemed to be a lot of discomfort over the possibility of Doctor Who not being prevalent next year within the organisation. Is there some sort of feeling within the organisation that this isn't necessary and that this is for other reasons other than for the benefit of Doctor Who and the flagship of the BBC, and that there's sort of political sparring going on and it's leaking a little into the public ground on the reasons for this? And maybe it's something rather personal, and again, I don't know for sure, that Moffat does actually want to split his time among TV shows.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we need to sort of underline the fact that whatever's going on, they obviously need to get on with it. But, as you say, James,
I'll throw it out there. I mean, it's one of those things that you find yourself sitting at home, you have a little bit too much fanboy time, so I started doing the numbers, and I realized that the 12th episode of Series 7 would actually factor out to be the 100th episode of new Doctor Who.
Were you actually watching numbers at the time as well?
Well, how else would I have done the math? Come on. No, but what I realized was is that not only that, but, you know, the anniversary for Doctor Who, November the 23rd, actually falls on a Saturday.
Yeah.
So if you pushed this series back in such a fashion that, you know, you did have sort of a gap year, you could essentially have the 100th episode fall on the 50th anniversary. And I don't know if it's something that they're sitting there going, this is too good an opportunity to miss. Let's just push it out. So this, and when you think about it, you have episode 12, you have 13 and 14. And then, and when I say episode 12, I'm including wherever they're putting the Christmas story. So it wouldn't be the actual episode 12. It would probably be their episode 11 of a full series. And if you follow that, so there would still be three episodes. There'd be 12, 13 and 14, if you want to look at it that way. So you could either have part one of an epic three part 50th anniversary story, or just a one epic anniversary story that marks not only the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, but the 100th episode of New Who. And like I said, I don't know if that means the production team is sitting there going, we can't miss this opportunity, or if they're sitting there going, hey, I really want to work on Sherlock, and this is a great excuse to say that this is why we're holding it off. You know, but they're still not saying one way or the other, but if they do it right, they can make that landmark happen as a twofold landmark. They can make that happen as a really interesting thing. At the same time, it's cool. It's really cool. I'd rather have a full series.
I just think that Moffat just needs to be a little more, I think, not just Moffat, I think the whole caboodle needs to be a little more adaptive to situations. And I'm just feeling that's not the case. I mean, Moffat, from his Twitter, seemed a little gruff about it. And I can imagine you feel a bit gruff about it. But that is the situation as it is. That's the problem that you're facing. And just knocking it aside and just saying you're going to have faith, I just don't think really helps the issue at all. And
I don't think using Twitter helps the issue.
I don't think Twitter helps.
I think
it's totally
fair enough for someone like, say, Paul Cornell, who he's, you know, he markets himself. Most of what he works on, he owns and creates.
Yeah.
It's absolutely fair enough. And he's pretty interesting and has some quite amusing posts in that. Stephen Moffat seems to be related mainly to what he's doing at that particular moment with relation to Doctor Who. He should probably not be using Twitter, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm surprised he does, to be honest. I mean, there seemed to be at one point, before Twitter came out in the Doctor Who forums and the like, as soon as a writer or someone became involved in Doctor Who, they sort of moved away from the forums, understandably. Yeah. And I can understand exactly why they do that. But now Twitter's become vogue. They don't seem to have that same sort of rationale, which is kind of odd. Because you've still got the same sort of thing. People are still replying to you. They're sending you messages. It's not that much different. Because remember when Moffat...
You also have a limited type of space that you can actually write stuff in. So you kind of get a full explanation into Twitter.
When you're a sort of dry dog lotsman to start off with, reducing what limited... but reducing that down to 140 characters is kind of asking for trouble in some cases.
Exactly. And I think that's sad because I think it does misrepresent Moffat a bit. I mean, I imagine he is dour. I've heard that he can be a bit of a grumbles, but then so could Russell T. Davis. But when your dialogue is dropped down to what, 70 characters or something, you're going to end up not showing your best side, or I don't think it helps at all. I don't think it helps his representation. I don't think this is helping the show. I don't think it's helping the BBC, and it's certainly not helping the fans and the people who love Doctor Who. No. I was just thinking that myself.
Right, okay. Well, we'll finish off.
No problem. Hey, look, they've announced that there are 14 episodes of Doctor Who. We know that it's not going anywhere. All we want to know is why there's a delay and when it's going to air. I mean, we should still be happy. Like, look, remember how long we did have to wait 1 year to forget which season it was, but we were desperately trying to find out, and then they hit us with, not only was there a Christmas episode, but there was another series, and then there was going to be a spin-off TV show and so on. So, I mean, like, we waited and we got some rather grand news. So maybe we're going to get some really good news, but it's just... straight answers is all they need to give us.
Well, that brings us to the end of this podcast with a K. At least two of us will return next week. And in the meantime, enjoy whatever Doctor Who related activities you're engaging in. Don't forget to check casterbris.com for the daily news. And we'll see you then. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
What's Casturbis.com?
It's, sorry, did you say .com or .om?
.om, yeah.
.om, that's a Buddhist Doctor Who site.
Buddhist, yeah, oh, I see, yeah. I should check that out, probably. Yeah.
You have to be sat in a particular way.
Is that, okay,
yeah,
I'll look it up. Is there another website for that?
You have to be sat cross-legged and have a Barry Letts biography with you.
Oh, crud.
You have to be celibate as well, which I think counts for most Doctor Who fans. So,
oh,
that old gag, eh?
Poor Brian. Oh.
Sorry, such a disappointed.
You guys are just getting even for me making you feel so bad about no series in 2012.